Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshanworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated and replaced with ecosystemic models, the new economic engines for the digital era. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of Shoshanworks, and joined today by my co-host, Dr. Vikram Shyam, and our guest, Sharone McPherson. Vic and Sharone, let's get started today with a brief overview of your backgrounds.
I'm Vic, and my background's in aerospace. So I used to be in propulsion, biomimetics in the past, and then moved into more strategy, advocacy, that kind of stuff. Been here for about 15 years, and a lot of it has to do with figuring out what's coming up next and trying to set up teams and methods and such to make that happen, find the right people. So that's pretty much it. And now I'm in CAS, so Convergent Aeronautic Solutions, and we're looking at complex problems, wicked problems, whatever people call it nowadays. And there's even super wicked problems that I know people
yeah.
I mean, more and more ways of distinguishing them. But anyway, it's like looking at things like health and education, and trying to see where can we make an impact as NASA and aeronautics and aerospace more generally, and not just in the present. So there's a lot of people working on short-term solutioning for problems. And our view is, even if we get these resolved, there's going to be issues that pop up 50 years from now, 100 years from now. So it's more of a long-term horizon. So trying to maintain that balance of trying to solve things now, but also keeping in mind what's going to happen in the future.
So I will jump in and then just be very brief. I'm right now based in Washington, D.C., but really grew up for most of my adult life living and working in Africa. So you want to talk about some super wicked problems. I'm definitely down with that. So for the past 20, really, I landed back here in March. And so for about 23 years, I really have worked at the intersection of water, energy, food, and land systems. My background professionally is banking and law, but I really just went deep into technologies starting about 15 years ago when I started to teach, because I really wanted to understand how we could leverage what at the time we really were referring to as exponentially growing technologies. Went to Singularity University, got to hang out with people like Ray Kurzweil and Peter Diamandis and all the folks who were there teaching at that time, because I wanted to take what in many cases was really technology that was developed in the United States, Silicon Valley, other kinds of innovation ecosystems, and deploy it in the developing world to save lives and livelihoods. So for me, technology has always been an enabler, and I believe that the best solutions are innovation, human ingenuity with the right strategy, with technology as an enabler. I became a foreign policy advisor for Biden, looking at infrastructure, national security, and climate, and really began to go deep. I teach project finance and have been very much interested, as I've said, water, energy, food, and land systems. But how do you model both the negative and positive externalities, particularly related to climate, so that you can begin to price assets, price deals in ways that really drive economic development. So all of this work that I'm doing right now is on some level a means to an end. I'm interested in shifting trillions of dollars into climate resilience. And I can only do that if we can get the pricing models right, et cetera. So that's a lot of the work that I'm doing right now.
What motivated you to take an interest in climate resilience?
I was asked to go to South Africa initially because of I spent a lot of time thinking about constitutional jurisprudence. I'm an attorney also by profession. I got there and I was asked to stay by Mandela. So I helped to set up the Nelson Mandela Foundation, worked a lot with his wife to set up the Gras Michel Trust. And then I was asked to teach because I've been doing all these infrastructure deals. And I realized that a lot of my students who came from India, China, the continent, all these places, they didn't have the capacity to, first of all, do the kind of really sophisticated transactions that I'd grown up on Wall Street doing. And then when you added the extra layer of climate, because I've been this nexus person, it was a wicked problem. I love that. It was a wicked problem for me because when I was pricing these infrastructure deals, I kept being aware that there was this category of risk that weren't priced in my transactions. That is initially how I got triggered, because South Africa and many of the markets in which we were doing these infrastructure projects were 15 years ago climate vulnerable. I mean, we were bathing in a bucket in Cape Town 5 or 6 years ago. So it was not this kind of amorphous name. It was a real thing for us, right? So I was really interested in how I could use engineering tools, other kinds of technology to really begin to measure the impact of climate on infrastructure projects, starting from a pricing perspective. And then I realized that was another level of complexity. I needed to teach about it. I needed to research about it, because our tools were not as advanced as our thinking. At least my tools were not as advanced as my thinking about it. So I struggled to really figure out how to get it done. I didn't have the models to get it done right. And yeah, so that's a long answer, but it really started from a due diligence, from a legal and a financial due diligence perspective, understanding that there was risk mitigation that needed to take place because I could see how climate was impacting, whether it was energy infrastructure or other kinds of infrastructure, but it was never priced into the deal.
Right. That makes sense. And I guess when people talk about Africa, they're talking about this monolith, but it's actually this whole bunch of different things happening everywhere.
54 countries and counting.
And then you have the Amazon's, the lungs of the ecosystem, right? And there's that switch between the Sahara and the Amazon, which has very much to do with climate change. Absolutely. And you talk about the water issues in South Africa.
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of different problems to keep track of. And when you talk about modeling, at what level did you feel like people were, I guess, didn't have the tools to model stuff? The decision making, understanding, communicating, or all of those?
Oh, really, all of those. And I felt like the first issue really has to do with definitions, because before we can get into KPIs and how to leverage technology to deal with big data, I think we first have to kind of step back and say, like, how was I defining and how do I define resilience? And then break that down. Because really, for me, resilience is really about people, places, and things. And I define resilience as an ability to climate resilience, as the ability to prepare for, respond to, adapt to, and thrive in adverse climate conditions. And that's important because I think the nomenclature matters if we're going to develop standards, which help us then to really actually answer the question that you're asking with high degrees of empirical rigor. And so when it comes to how do you begin to measure it with respect to people, we look at things like the exposure, the sensitivity, and the adaptive capacity. When it comes to measuring the resilience of places, we have developed a modified index that has 139 indicators. And so that's place-based resilience. And then if you want to talk about how do you measure the resilience of a thing, of course, it depends on that thing. But quite often, you're talking about some kind of physical climate risk analysis, which isn't the same as resilience. But when you take a wider lens and you say you look at that asset within the context of the place, within the context of the people, then you can start to get a resilience score. And so it can become quite complex really quickly.
Yeah, it seems like each of the things you mentioned by themselves is a large undertaking, or itself is a complex system. So do you have different groups working on each one of these that you then put together? Or how do you orchestrate that?
Funny that you should say that, because the business model that we develop actually is one of network orchestration. And so the same way that you would have a network orchestrator in an IT system, that's how we operate. And that business model is kind of complex, it's kind of new, but it is what we do. And so for a long time, Vic, just as you have suggested, we had kind of social science kind of people dealing with a lot of the people and the place-based analysis. And then kind of physical climate risk modeling is something that has grown out of business continuity planning. And there are all kinds of tools and that have been developed and used historically. What my approach and the model that I'm still working on developing that needs to be validated is that resilience within any context always involves people, places, and things. So how do you create a more comprehensive model that within the confines of that model itself has the capacity to measure indicators related to those three major subdomains? And that's the work that I am doing now, which AI is helping a lot, as well as how we've evolved in terms of data science.
I'm fascinated by this, just the interplay of the different sub-ecosystems, right, of impact and measure, right? So do you feel like the tools are catching up? You mentioned AI is helping this progress, but this is basically a complex system or system of systems that you're knitting together. Do you feel like the tools are coming along to give you kind of better decisioning support?
Yes, Diane, absolutely. I think I just want to do this all day, every day. I get up and this is really all I want to do. And that's all I want to talk about. So I'm really enjoying the conversation because, yeah, I mean, I think we're at a place where, you know, breakthroughs. I mean, for example, one of the types of AI, of course, there are many different types of AI and AI has been with us anyway for a long time. But I'm one of the things that we're exploring right now is how to use mesh AI in our modeling. And so, yeah, I feel like the tools are there. I feel like breakthroughs are happening at an exponential pace. And so I think that in addition to the tools having evolved, I think our thinking has evolved in terms of policy. And so we can talk about this stuff from a policy point of view and have it make sense. And so I think that the policy and the regulation is there. So there's the impetus. Businesses are incredibly incentivized. Not just from a reporting and a compliance perspective, but part of what I'm really looking to do with the tools is to begin to price resilience in a way that we're able to align values amongst major stakeholder groups so that whether I'm owner of a single family dwelling or a multifamily dwelling, I'm in sync with my mortgage lender, with the purchaser of those mortgage loans, which could be a big entity like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, as well as with the Citibank guy who sold me the loan, right? And so how I make those decisions about taking out a home equity loan, for example, to make my property more resilient to floods, which is one of the biggest destroyers of value in our economy in terms of climate hazards. Why hasn't there been more action? There hasn't been more action because of that lack of alignment of values. And so you've got to be able to price that so that values get aligned and people take action.
Yeah, it's so, so important. And to your point, the disconnect in the flows of information and the design of the incentive systems, right? And the interaction of these various networks across a broader ecosystem that are interdependent, but aren't necessarily connected in the way information flows or incentive is designed. That's driven some inefficiencies across systems and some sub-optimization across those systems too. So we've often had the conversations about the design of governance systems and the ability of policymakers to pace with the innovation, the capabilities within these new innovation fronts in order to basically extract greater value from what is possible to be unlocked within the new innovation systems. But the policy and the governance design has historically lagged. But it sounds like some of these models will now kind of bring those into greater alignment, that the flows of information and the design of the incentive systems can now pace a little bit more closely with what is possible as new innovation is unlocked, if I'm understanding the design of your modeling systems. Is that the intent?
But yes and no. So I think on a sort of a high level, if we just kind of come back to the United States and we look at, you've got federal, you've got your major government sponsored entities, But a lot of, and so a lot happens within FEMA, within NASA, within NOAA, right? And different types of federal agencies. But if we're talking about climate resilience as a thing, that happens at the local level. Yeah, right. Events happen to people in a place and that touching down on Earth. So if we stick with like the example of flood within the United States as a country, we've got great models, indices that come out of organizations like FEMA, like NOAA and others. We rely a great deal on data that's been generated by organizations like NASA. So we can kind of try to understand, for example, how a region floods, right? But we know that when you get hyper local, it gets really wonky. So we can come back to the question about technology and how that enables us to have insights that are actionable. But if you kind of look at, stick with flooding, whether it's all different kinds of flooding, the fact of the matter is within a state, you have a regulator of insurance, right? So insurance is regulated. And so we know that whether you're talking about wildfires in California or flooding in a place very close to where I'm sitting right now, Baltimore, right? Right. Baltimore floods a lot, has lots of rivers, lots going on in terms of Baltimore and with this ecosystem and flooding. But when it comes to the insurance question, which is huge for how that market operates efficiently, if we stick with flooding and housing, insurance plays a huge role. But insurance regulators, I would say probably there's maybe 7 or 8 states in the United States where insurance regulators have really been proactive in how they allow in, say, interesting things we can do now that we've got the technology and the insights, right? Earth observation technologies help us to use things like synthetic aperture radar to better figure out how flooding happens in a high density area. But if we can't get the state insurer to allow us to do a parametric flood insurance project, then that's hard because then you can't make the payout easy and fast, which is what people on the ground want. So yes, I think from a macro perspective, lots of interesting things happening, both from a compliance and governance perspective in terms of regulation. But I think when it comes to regulated industries, there's a lot more that we can do, whether we're talking about insurance, whether we're talking about energy, where we can really facilitate how people on the ground can benefit from the innovation that's actually happening.
100%, 100%. And are those some of the outcomes that you're designing for in your models and systems and advisory work? Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right, which is to Vic's point about network orchestration. So we thought that we could show up and say, wow, we've got new technological breakthroughs. We've got great models. We want to kick the door open and come in, pardon the metaphor, but like guns blazing to really shoot the lights out and make something happen in terms of impact where it counts. And then what we realized very quickly was that we were going to have to network orchestrate because quite often businesses are not speaking the same language as community, isn't speaking the same language as government. And so part of what is really challenging when you look at like all the goodwill and the resources that can come from, say, a National Science Foundation grant, which funded, by the way, a parametric insurance pilot in the city of New York, right? And we're working on that to try to expand it. And so it's a live case study. But the point that I'm making is so often, whether it's NASA, FEMA, NOAA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, you name it, there is a huge amount of network orchestration that happens, right? The Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, $27 billion. But so often what's missing in those projects is the glue, first of all, that can hold all the various stakeholders together and help to tease out those values, align them so that we're all kind of speaking same language, values aligned, and we are able to orchestrate that network to drive the impact that we all care about. There has to be more than that. And so we realized that was going to have to be part of our business model. Otherwise, we were never going to, it was going to be incredibly difficult to get to the place where we were able to deploy the innovation, the tech solutions that we could create it was going to be difficult for us to do that and create the impact that we're looking for.
When you talk about the tech solutions and such, you're talking about things like, you mentioned synthetic aperture radar, or you talk about something more local?
Well, I mean, what we're looking at now, we're working on a number of pilots so that we can validate our own model, which takes us back to that people, places, and thing, that approach to how we want to measure resilience so that we can drive capital into resilience investing, which is all about mitigation, right? So right now, what we're doing is we're partnering, well, to just give you an example of some of the tech solutions, because right now it's not so much about local tech solutions, but I want to get there, right? Because I believe in proximate leadership. I believe that the best people to help to solve some of the wicked challenges that we're trying to address are actually people who live in proximity to the thing, right? Right now, what we're doing is we're trying to validate our model and really come up with solutions that can scale, because people are dying. People are losing their jobs. The majority of small and medium businesses don't come back after they've been subject to some kind of severe climate-related event, a hurricane, for example. Most of those small and medium-sized businesses don't come back. And so what we're trying to do right now is really look at solutions that can scale with respect to some of the biggest destroyers of lives and livelihoods, which is why we're focusing so much energy on flood. And we're partnering with big earth observation companies and academic institutions, which do have people from the communities. The other thing I will say that we're going to continue to figure out how we can get it right is, how do we leverage the incredible amount of innovation, ideation, creative, and just labor that sits within academic institutions, because that's a good source of talent and technology. And I think that those ecosystems quite often have not been sufficiently explored in terms of how you leverage the technology that comes out. Some do, Stanford, others do a great job, but I think that there are lots of other universities right in the areas where we want to continue to do these pilots, where there are local technology solutions that could be right for us.
Right. Yeah. So I guess you brought up an interesting point, which was the validation and the measuring results and resilience, right? And so when I think about past efforts, even when people are studying ecology and ecosystems, one of the biggest limitations is those factors that you brought up, which is like the people, places, and things. And almost like that card, the game you play, right? People, places, names, things. And you're limited by the things that you know, almost. And you can come up with a model that seems right to pretty much everyone that's been involved, because they've got that limited vision of, here's how things interact. But how do you actually know that you've modeled all the parts? And I'm guessing AI probably has a role to play in this, in terms of mining connections in the ecosystem.
Yeah.
But even if you're measuring something, let's say it's something macroscopic, like let's say it's flooding or drought, you might be getting that right. But how does that give you confidence in, let's say, secondary effects or third order effects and such that might come about later on? How do you build that confidence into your model?
So let's go back to what sits in the model. So, because I agree, I mean, we're trying to solve simultaneous systems of equations, and you really want to hold as many variables in those equations constant as possible, right? So if we go and we look at where we started with respect to how you measure the climate resilience of a person, we started with three big buckets that have been validated by the National Institute of Health. And those three big buckets are exposure, right? As in the actual hazard, right? So the exposure. And then the second bucket is sensitivity, right? What are all the factors that relate to a person's sensitivity to that exposure? Because that's going to impact their climate resilience / vulnerability. And then the third is their adaptive capacity, right? So we didn't make that up. That's been validated. That's NIH. Those are NIH factors. And we know where we can get that data, right? So you can start there. And then if you look at place-based climate resilience analysis, what we started with was the baseline resilience indicators for communities, which was developed by the University of South Carolina's Hazard and Resilience Center. And that's one of the indices that's used by FEMA and NOAA. We modified it because we felt that it needed to be enhanced in terms of its capacity to measure vulnerability as well. Because if I can't understand your vulnerabilities, I don't know where to tell you put your money, right? All right. So we did a modification of BRICS that was anchored in a theory of change that had also been validated. And that's called the DROP model, the Disaster Resilience of Place model. Okay. And then when we look at how we go about the physical, the thing, which generally is some kind of physical climate risk analysis, what we have based that on is the PCRM methodology that was actually developed by the G20, right? And so what we wanted to do was to try to hold as many variables constant by saying, what are the validated methods and methodologies that we can draw upon and then widen the lens so that our intellectual property is how do you connect the dots between these three types of methods so that you get a composite score that's an accurate reflection of both the ontology between those factors as well, right? So that's really kind of what makes our approach unique, because it's not just a physical climate risk analysis, or it's not just a place-based. And by the way, almost all of those methods already bleed somewhat into one another, right? So if you look at how the BRICS index works, it takes into consideration some of the social science elements that you would see in a NIH analysis of an individual. It's just at the community level. It's done by zip code, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we wanted to really be able to widen the lens in a way that we hope will result in the standardization of resilience measurement and analysis so that we can create a common language and a common platform for analysis that speaks language of people, communities, and businesses, and government as a representative of the people.
So helpful. And I would imagine that as this evolves and matures, your thinking matures through this process, you'll have a pretty good lock on the level of, so as you're starting to kind of isolate in on a more kind of a defined location, right? Because the composite score, I'm sure, will differ pretty significantly depending on the nature of the threat or the nature of the location. And that location is going to be more attuned to certain types of threats based on historical experience, right? So
absolutely,
you'll no doubt have a pretty good sense for as that measure kind of ladders up or ladders down into a more focused arena of study, you'll have a pretty good sense for what the composite score is for that level of granularity, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And you really hit the nail on the head. And that's a tall order, because climate science becomes quite wonky when it gets down to the local county level, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we have great like models for saying generally what may happen. But if you look at, for example, the parametric flood insurance pilot that the National Science Foundation grant funded in New York, it hasn't paid out yet. And part of why it hasn't paid out is because those zip codes experienced enormous flooding for 2 years straight, and then the rain was fickle. So the parametric triggers were never triggered. And so there was never a payout, right? Because climate change isn't linear, right? You can't just look at what happened in the past and say, this is absolutely what's going to happen at this spot on the planet. And so that's why I think something that Vic mentioned earlier, you really want to get AI, big data in so that you can begin to figure out, how do you leverage our capacity to predict? How do we get better at saying there are all of these unknowns, there's all this uncertainty, but how do we begin to really sort of predict better so that we can prepare better and not always be on the back foot trying to clean up after the storm has happened. And so that's ultimately where we want to go, which is why I think resilience investing is so absolute key, because without investing in that, then you actually really have a compromised ability to adapt and to mitigate, because you're always cleaning up.
Right, right. Yeah, you're reacting. Exactly. And so the future scenarios, how much you're able to really anticipate basically a portfolio of scenarios at the macro level and then down at the community level, are you starting to leverage the capability within AI and potentially even mesh AI to start to tease out a portfolio of future scenarios?
Yeah, absolutely. And I did. I mentioned mesh AI. And I also just want to say, Diane, that there are lots of companies that can help you to scenario plan. There are great companies in terms of creating digital twins, and that can help you to roll out those scenarios. We are, our aim at Resilience X isn't really to be that company. We really want to be the resilience people. We want to be able to give you a score that's almost like a FICO score. It's ubiquitous and everyone knows it. Just like when you think about, why do you know what your FICO score is? Well, you know what your FICO score is because you want credit, right? And you, and we want you to know what your resilience score is because you want to be resilient, because that is actually connected to your capacity to access credit or your capacity to actually build back after the storm, et cetera, et cetera. So the answer to that question is yes, that's part of it. But what we really want is behavior change. That's what we're really after. And we want to simplify climate resilience scoring and link it to the things we care about, like getting a loan or having access to credit, so that they can begin to change their behavior and understand that, wow, this has broader implications. Whoa, I'm living in an area where I'm subject to extreme heat and my grandmother is 95 years old. And if we experience another power outage for 8 hours because of her pre-existing health condition, we're going to have a problem. So I want to be looking at our resilience score so that I can know exactly what I need to do to better take care of my grandma. And so there are lots of companies. Love Jupiter Intelligence. We love One Concern. They are not really competitors. They do a great job. The last thing I will say before we kind of go on to another topic is one of the challenges that we're facing in the market is something that you talked about a little bit, Diane, already, and that's access to information asymmetry is a huge problem. And one of the things that's happening is the big rating agencies, Standard & Poor's, Fitch, Moody, just to name a couple of them, they're gobbling up companies that really have deep knowledge in terms of climate resilience, analytics, insights, because they want to be able to offer those services to big corporates, enterprise level organizations, government, and they're paid very handsomely to do that work. The challenge is how do you make that available to the person who needs to take care of her grandma, or the small and medium enterprises that are the backbone of our economy that don't have access to that kind of knowledge and information? And they're not using NASA, NOAA, and FEMA's tools either, because they find them to be too difficult to navigate, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have that level of sophistication. So how do you begin to provide them with insights that are actionable, that are affordable in a way that's going to modify their behavior so that this ramps up and it scales very quickly? That's what we're after. We want to be part of that solution.
So it's almost like we planned. Thanks for bringing that back to behavior modification, because my next question was actually going to be around, so very often we talk about, when we focus on Africa, we talk about, you know, bringing technology into Africa and learning from, let's say, the quote-unquote West, right? But nowadays, as things are becoming more connected, we're realizing the benefit of different societal structures, may not be technological structures, but that existed in the past, not just from Africa, but also from East Asia and such. And people are looking at, for example, organizational methods, educational methods, ways of communicating, making decisions, like community-based decision-making. And I'm wondering if there are any lessons through your observations in different parts of Africa, and even with the climate resilience work. Anything, any lessons that maybe we can learn and apply, let's say over here in the US, especially from what you've seen over there?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting about the work that I've done historically in on the African continent and really across about 14 markets, because as you said right at the beginning, Africa is not monolithic. If you're in South Africa, you drive right across the border and you are in a country where people are speaking a very different language than the 11 official languages that are spoken within South Africa, right? You can be in Mozambique and people are speaking Portuguese. And so across the 14 markets that I have experienced, including Mozambique, it's young. People are young. Africa has over 200 million people between the ages of 15 and 34. So it's remarkable how adaptive they are, right? And how hungry they are for change and how willing they are to actually deploy US-based technologies in ways that we don't deploy here in the United States. Right. And so one of the reasons why I mentioned the age, the average age of an African, is because we have so many people in Africa who are digital natives. They're not digital immigrants. I come back to the United States and I'm often struck by how old we are. Right. Including myself, right? I feel younger when I'm in Africa. I come back and I start feeling my age. And I say that because one of the things that I've learned is that stories matter and how you tell those stories matter. And in Africa, I think we are really a lot more adept at using digital technology to tell our stories in ways that I think are really impactful. And one of the things that I am exploring in one of the pilots that we're hoping to get off the ground here in the United States with one of the big GSEs around flooding and insurance is, how do you tell that story better? How do you leverage digital media strategies and technologies to tell that story better? Right. And so I think that if there's anything that I've learned, is that we've got to tell the stories better, and we've got to understand the nudges and the boost. So there's a marketing communications angle that often is not properly fleshed out and is not executed properly. So as network orchestrators, one of the first things that we're doing is figuring out how we can get some of the most advanced marketing communications experts involved so that they can start baking in the behavior change messaging right from the beginning. But also, we need to understand what are the platforms for communicating that to the right people at the right time. And so often, I don't think that is fully embraced or understood. And so that you can get the people in the room who can help you have a mindset change so that you can embrace it. We think about it as something that's nice to have, but it isn't. It's critical.
It's absolutely critical, right? Those connections and connectors they're really the infrastructure to change, right? But you have to be very intentional about the design. You need to understand, right, that extended network, right? And basically the actors within that extended network and what systems of incentive and interaction are going to drive the best experiences and outcomes, right?
Absolutely.
It's not natural. I love the characterization of digital immigrants versus digital natives. I think digital natives tend to think more naturally in that frame versus the digital immigrants. But we all have to start thinking more in terms of network orchestration, because these flows of information and interactions and incentives it's just a different landscape for our economy and our society now than it was in, you know, the previous generations. So as we think about that, Sharon, maybe a few tips for our listeners. How can our listeners start thinking more in terms of network orchestration design and maybe kind of understanding that systems of, or how to design, better design systems of governance an incentive in order to drive better experiences and outcomes just within that kind of more network work orchestration model for change?
Yeah. I think the first thing, Diane, is to understand, well, not just understand, but to acknowledge and agree that we do not all have shared values. I think so often what happens is we create policy, we create programs and initiatives, and we assume that the people that we are aligning with to roll out the program or the people that we're rolling out the program or initiative to share our values. And we haven't bothered to actually really fully articulate what those values are, nor have we done the work to say, what are the values of the stakeholders who are involved in making this a success? So we don't have that values alignment process.
Yes.
Because if I want you to change your behavior, I have to understand what your values are. It's not good enough for me to say, I want to decrease the amount of time and resources that I spend cleaning stuff up, which is part of FEMA's mandate, right? But if I don't understand what really is driving the folks in Appalachia versus Puerto Rico, then I'm not going to get that messaging right, because the way that I deliver that message about resilience in Puerto Rico is going to be very different than if I'm in Appalachia.
100%.
Right? Yeah. So I think if there was one kind of thing that I think we need to do right up front is to have a values alignment process to say they're intertwined quite often, but they're not aligned. And then the second thing we need to do is then to figure out, like, what are the key actions that need to be taken in order to drive the impact at this intersection of common ground where the values are aligned? Start there. Right. Then we can talk about getting the messaging right, because we're clear about the KPIs, we're clear about the steps, and we're clear about where we've got agreement and where perhaps we don't. So we save the willing first. Let's start there. Where are those folks who are, they're there. We just gotta get that messaging, get that resources out. I think we can do that. We've got the resource to do it. I just think that we don't always have the awareness that it needs to be done.
Yeah. It requires a shift in mindset, right? A little bit more empathy, a little bit more humility, a little bit more curiosity, right? In order to get out of your own orientation and understand what motivates the various actors, the critical actors within this landscape, and the landscape evolves, right? Some constellations light up, to your point. What are the relevant connections and motivations there? Some deactivate. So it's a very dynamic, evolving kind of model in order to kind of understand how to drive value, orchestrate the greatest possible value within that system. Vic, I think you were jumping in here as well.
Well, if there's time, sure. So when you talked about values, yeah, very often that leads into even when people talk about what's an ideal future, right? That's almost, it's building on a bunch of values that people have. And very often that's different for everyone. And then we assume that when we vote or we make decisions that we're all seeing the same ideal vision of the future. We're not. So that makes sense. And similarly, it's the assumptions we make about the systems we live in. We assume that we need to somehow protect the systems that we have rather than changing them. And I was going to bring up the question of, I think in Zimbabwe, they're talking about these little trade shops that are coming up. And I think the government's worried about how there's almost two competing economies now. So things like that, when you're building this complex system that's, you've got these economic models that are trying to incentivize certain behaviors even, but then you have the people maybe, and supposedly this is forced by drought and by shortage of food and such. You have these alternative systems coming up. How do you decide whether you need to completely change tracks, listen maybe to the community level people, or maybe it's going to be deleterious? How do you make that decision? Because it may just blow up the model, right?
Yeah, but I think the approach would be the same. And I love that example, Vic, in terms of the informal economy. I've spent a lot of time in the trenches. In my first conversation with Diana, we were laughing, but it was true. I mean, I've been shot at before. I mean, this stuff is serious. I mean, because people quite often are desperate. You know, what we're talking about impacts people's lives and livelihoods. And they can quickly lose their sense of humor because they don't have access to the things that they need in order to be well. And so if you look at, for example, in Zimbabwe, where you have an informal economy, I'm sure you can look across Africa, you would have the same conversation and in many places within the developing world, right? Okay. But one of the challenges, if you go back and you use that example from a local economic development point of view, I care about the formal economy because I've got a fiscus and I need people to pay taxes so that I can fund things like disaster response, right? And so informal businesses are notorious for not paying taxes. Okay, let's just start there. And then you've got the community, which is like, hang on for a second. We are a favela, or we're a township, or we're some kind of what we call here in the United States, LIDAC, low income disadvantaged community, right? And so we live in food deserts. And if mama over here is going to sell me fat cakes on the corner, well, for 5 cents a pop, I'm going to go and buy the fat cakes on the corner because they're keeping my belly full, right? So please, because I don't have a lot of established supermarkets in my food desert. Okay, right? And so you've got the community perspective and language on that. But at the same time, that community needs disaster response, don't they? They need the garbage to be collected. They need the funding for schools and all the other public goods that government can provide, right? And so, and then you've got, of course, the business perspective, which can be all over the show, depending on whether that business sees these folks as viable clients or customers, or whether the businesses too often don't understand that even if you're not selling things directly, some of the people who work in your fast food restaurant live there. Yeah, they do, right? So it goes back to this kind of network orchestration business model and how you really do need folks to come in and what we would call in Zimbabwe or in some South Africa to have a lohotla, or that council meeting where you've got the business, you've got the government, you've got the mama selling fat cake. She's got her representative there. She's not there herself. She is. She's probably going to scare the life out of everybody and they're going to quickly get into shape, right? And then you've got the various stakeholders and you're able to find that place where you say, can we create a designated area where for some kind of small fee, we've got trash removal, you can plug into the internet, you can do your selling of your stuff. 50 of you can gather there and sell all of your stuff in some kind of way that meets the needs of the community, where we're not dealing with the obstruction, egress, ingress to an established business, for example, because you're selling at the front door and the business doesn't like it. So there are all kinds of solutions if we just, I think, apply this thinking and begin to have deeper conversations and then figure out what technology as the right enabler.
Yeah, so right, so right. And what I love so much about this, Sharon, is the marriage of relationship and trust and empathy with advanced technology, right? So at the heart of kind of where we started is really a very advanced kind of data model, right? You're beginning to leverage the data and understand the connections and the connectors in order to build better models to unlock greater understanding and access and value. And that is possible and enabled and informed and propelled by the relationships that you establish in the meantime, because the models will have to constantly evolve, right? As society and industry and policy evolve, and we all have to trust each other, right? There needs to be some grace in the evolution of not only the decision support tools, but also the relationships that are really improved by these tools and capabilities. So yeah. With that, Sharon, I think we will need to wrap it up, but no doubt we and our listeners will continue to follow the amazing work that you're leading. And we're grateful for the work that you're leading. And we hope to continue this conversation and stay in touch. But thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, Vic. And you're right. Lekgotla, Lekgotla. It is a thing. It's a method. All right. Looking forward. Keep well. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shoshimeworks.com.